Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In Hollow Men, Strange Women, Riddles, Codes, and Otherness in the Book of Judges, Robin Baker provides a masterly reappraisal of Israel's experience during its settlement of Canaan in the Book of Judges, which he argues subtly encrypts a grim forewarning of Judah's future. He also shows how, in its extensive treatment of otherness, the Book of Judges explores the meaning of God's covenant with Israel. You're listening to New Books and Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network, and I'm your host, Michael Morales. Robin Baker is Professor Emeritus of Old Testament and Ancient Near Eastern Studies in the School of History, Archaeology, and Philosophy at University of Winchester, and Fellow of University College London. His latest monograph is Mesopotamian Civilization and the Origins of the New Testament. Robin, welcome to New Books and Biblical Studies.
Thank you, Michael.
So by way of introducing yourself, Robin, how did you get interested in the Book of Judges?
Well, a very long time ago, when I was at school, one of our set books was John Milton's Samson Agonistes, which is a very, very powerful text and looks at the story of Samson from the point of view of someone who was themselves a theologian, but also a blind theologian by that stage. So the whole idea of blindness and what it meant in Samson's life and what it meant to Milton trying to figure out who God was very powerful. So that really attracted me. But then in my first year of undergraduate Hebrew, one of our set texts was, again, Samson, Judges 14. And when I studied the text, and, you know, it's all about Samson going to his bride-to-be and being attacked by the lion and then overcoming the lion and then going back and finding the lion carcass in the vineyard with the hive of bees buzzing around it. And then the whole riddle story comes through in this. And I was fascinated by the whole idea of the riddle because apparently the Philistines got the answer right. They got it right by cheating, but they got it right. And that was, what is stronger than a lion and what is sweeter than honey? But there's a problem with this. And that's what struck me. There's a problem. There's a problem with their answer. I mean, Samson accepted it as the right answer. But if you think about it, something was stronger than a lion to kill it. And what was the thing that was stronger than the lion? It wasn't Samson. It was the Spirit of God came on Samson, and he tore it like you would tear a goat kid. And then what's sweeter than honey? Well, maybe nothing, but this was very special honey because it was in a dead animal. It was ritually impure. And here you have the Nazarite Samson with the long hair and the long beard going to the vineyard and scraping out from inside this dead body some honey. And what really struck me about this is the Hebrew word that's used for how he does it, because it says he scraped it out with his paws, kapal, And there is one place where this word is used of four-footed creatures in Leviticus, and I'm sure, Michael, you know this, where it says that any creature that walks on its paws is unclean. So in this very few verses, you have this such a rich theological message and such a deep one because, you know, there are so many layers to unpack with this story. So that's a rather long-winded answer to your question, but I hope it gives you a flavor for why Judges attracted me early on.
One of your contributions to the study of Judges is in understanding its rhetorical structure. In your book, you point out what you and the Masoretes consider the center of the work. Would you tell us about this and its implications for the message of Judges?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Masoretes were very clear that the midpoint of the book of Judges falls in chapter 10, in verse 6-7. And they were very interested in this whole idea of where is the midpoint of the book, because obviously the beginning and the end, it's self-evident. Because, and this is where I think it sometimes people trip up when they try and understand Judges. Judges was not written by someone who'd read Jane Austen. They came from an entirely different literary background. And the literary background they came from was an ancient Near Eastern one. And in the ancient Near East, the midpoint of the composition was considered to have enormous weight as the kind of pivot on which meaning swung. So that's why the Masoretes were interested in what's the midpoint. And in Judges, I mean, in some books it's a little hazy, but in Judges it's a bullseye, because the midpoint is the list of the seven gods that Israel prostituted herself after. And the seven gods, very interesting how it's laid out. It's Baals, Ashtaroth, gods of Syria, gods of Sidon, gods of Moab, gods of the Ammonites, gods of the Philistines. Now, why is that interesting? Well, first of all, it summarizes the problem of Judges, that there was an irresistible attraction on the part of the Israelites in that settlement period to go after other gods. But the way it's laid out is also interesting, because you have five sets of gods of Syria, gods of Moab, etc. And then you have two discrete items, Baals and Ashtaroth. Now, in terms of the Hebrew and indeed ancient Near Eastern Babylonian understanding of the heavens, it comprised seven principal parts: the sun, the moon, and then the five planets. So we find here in this list of seven, and of course seven is hugely symbolic in the Bible, and it's hugely symbolic in Judges. Here you have that laid out. And at this point in 10:6-7, you have an intersection of another set of seven, which were key, which were the seven times Israel was doing evil. So through the book, beginning with chapter 2, verse 11, through to 13:1, there are 7 points where it explicitly says, repeats, Israel did evil. And one of them is 10:6. And that leads us into the list of gods. So from that point of view, it's absolutely, as I say, summarizes the problem. Now, what else does it do? Well, there are lots of ways that it balances one side with the other. But I'll just give you a couple of examples. One is that I believe, I mean, one thing which is great about Judges, it is uniquely rich in the Hebrew Bible in that in the array of different literary devices it has. So we have a parable, we have a song, Song of Deborah, we have an aphorism when Gideon's talking about the vintage. We have a tongue twister. And we also have not just the riddle, but also a password of Shibboleth. So here you have these extraordinary, this extraordinary range of different literary techniques. But one of them, I've mentioned, parable, is on one side of the line, and the other, riddle, is on the other side of the line. So the parable comes from Jotham when he's talking about Abimelech from Mount Gerizim. He gives a parable of the trees, and then the riddle, as we've mentioned, comes from Samson. And I believe that these two devices and the way they are framed actually helps us understand lots about the book of Judges. So that's there. Then we have the judges, the minor judges. They are lined up, two on one side of the midpoint, three on the other. And lots of other ways that this midpoint is significant. But there is something else I should mention, because Judges, one of the most wonderful things about Judges, richest things about Judges, is its interest in binaries. It is absolutely obsessed with two-ness. And we find that in all sorts of ways. And so Judges doesn't just have one structure, it actually has two structures. So the one structure we've been talking about is the one that starts at verse 1:1 and ends at the end of chapter 21. And we've talked about where that is. But the other structure is the major judge structure, which goes from, I think it's 3:12 through to 16:31 with the death and burial of Samson. And both of them are significant.
You also discussed the leitmotif of otherness in Judges. Would you explain that concept for us, perhaps with a few examples from Judges?
Yeah, sure. Now, there is a very clear line of otherness in the judges themselves, the six judges. They become progressively less genetical and much more cultic as we go through the list. So you start off with Othniel, who many commentaries will say is the perfect judge. There's flawless. There's nothing other about him. He's from the tribe of Judah, does nothing wrong, does what he's supposed to do single-handedly. But actually, Othniel is not even technically an Israelite. He's an Edomite. So here you have a group that had been, the Kenizzites, that had been absorbed into the tribe of Judah, but he's not an Israelite. So the second one we come to is Ehud, who is probably the first named left-handed person in the history of the world. And then we get to Deborah. Well, Deborah's a woman. And a prophetess. And how do we, I mean, this is wonderful how the writer stresses this. The first seven words that introduce Deborah in chapter 4 all have feminine endings. So it's Deborah, a woman, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth. She was judging. All of those words have a feminine ending. Even the name of her husband has a feminine ending. So her gender is clearly absolutely central to this story. And then we come to Gideon, who is from the tribe of Manasseh, which was, as it were, second to Ephraim, but in the tribe of Manasseh, the lowest clan. And then his father has got a Baal altar and an Asherah pole. So they're not actually a great family to start with. Then you get Jephthah, whose mother was a sex worker, who was an outlaw. And then, of course, you get Samson, who is, in a way, the most other of all because he was separated by his Nazarite status. So otherness is written right through the work. But why is this important? It's important for the principal reason that in following other gods, they made Yahweh other. So all his representatives are in some way other. All of these six were chosen specifically by Yahweh to represent Yahweh's will and word to his people. So by being other as Yahweh, it is natural that his representatives would be other. And more than that, the more distant the people of Israel become from Yahweh, the more other the representatives become.
It seems like your approach to the book of Judges bears fruit, especially in the stories of Samson. Give us a glimpse of how you interpret the message of the Samson narratives.
Well, I mean, at the most basic level, it's a message of election, sin, and redemption. And if you like, that is the whole story of the people of Israel. They were elected, they sinned, but they're redeemed in the wonderful plan of God. They're not redeemed in the book of Judges, I have to say, because the book of Judges, in a very, very clever way, actually picks up the whole history of the tribes of Israel. In 2:1, the angel appears in Bochim and talks about bringing them up from the land of Egypt into the promised land, which is the start of the 12 tribes. You know, Exodus 1 begins with these are the names, and there's the 12 names. And then it ends in the story of 1830, where it talks about the Assyrian removal of the people from the land. So the 10 tribes go. So you have the whole sweep in two verses. It is phenomenal, the genius of this book. So Samson, in a sense, encapsulates that whole story. But of course, it's meaningful on lots of levels too, because what happens in his redemption is here is someone who has been empowered by God, who has thrown away that calling progressively. I mean, there's no point in the history of Samson where he's at all interested in the fact that he was called. He uses the strength to get what he wants, whether it's women or vengeance or whatever it is. He uses that strength. It's not for God's purpose, and he is the only judge who does not in any way deliver Israel. But what happens to Samson? He's actually betrayed, not just by the two Philistine women in his life, but by the tribe of Judah. And if we look at the story from chapter 1, it begins with the tribe of Judah, and it ends in chapter 18, 19, 20, 21, with... 17 and 18 with the Danites. And you get the same picture with the judges. As I've said, Othniel goes to Samson. So where does this take us? Well, it's not just the Danites who are the villains in the book of Judges, but the last chosen judge, representative of Yahweh, that is featured, was betrayed by Judah. So it captures all of them, all the 12 tribes in this sin.
You also discuss a key, a 3+1 pattern in Judges. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I go into this in some detail in the book. I mean, it's far more interesting than it sounds. It comes from the parable, Jotham's parable, where you have the four trees that are approached by the other trees to be the king. And the three good trees, the olive, the fig, and the vine, say we're not interested. What we do is honor God and man, or please God and man. We are content with that. We don't want to get into some kind of rulership. But then the really useless plant, the thorn bush, says, okay, I'll do it. But I'll only do it on certain conditions. And the conditions are very, very vicious, violent. If you don't obey me, then I will burn you up. So I'm suggesting in the book that this pattern is a key to understanding how this book works. So, and we see it everywhere, actually, in Judges and in all the stories. So in the story of Samson, just to take him again, there are four times Delilah says to him, tell me, where does your strength come from? And the first three times he says, gives her a story. They each get progressively closer to the truth. But it's on the fourth occasion that he tells her the truth. And of course, that's the end of him. That's the end of him as a free and sighted person. And this is the same pattern that you get in 3+1. It always has a sinister meaning, and it generally has a bad end. So I'll give you another example, which is from Gideon in chapter 8. So the Gideon's been successful in defeating the Midianites against all the odds, and the jubilant Israelites say to him, and I will quote this, rule over us, you, your son, and your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. So there you get a 3+1. So three rules, and then one an explanation, you've delivered us. Okay, well, that's, so what? Well, what happens next? We get another 3+1. And Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. Yahweh will rule over you. Fantastic. It's not even a 3+1. It's a 3. And we end with Yahweh. But that's not where we end. Because then he adds, and Gideon said to them, but I have a request of you that you would give me every man the earrings of his booty. Wow. So then we move to idolatry. We move to the whole thing about was Gideon a king or not, because he acted like one. And we certainly come into Abimelech. So there are many, many examples I could give you, Michael, but I hope that gives a flavor.
So what's on the horizon for you in terms of publishing?
Yeah, thank you. Well, my most recent monograph has been on something very different, which is looking at the New Testament from the point of view of Mesopotamia. And it's called Mesopotamian Civilization and the Origins of the New Testament. And it's published by Cambridge University Press. It came out in 22. And I've just signed a contract with Cambridge University Press to write the commentary on Nahum, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah for their new Cambridge Biblical Commentary series.
Robin, it's been a terrific look at Judges. Thank you for joining us on the show.
No, it's my pleasure, Mike. Well, thank you.
Friends, you've been listening to New Books and Biblical Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. Goodbye.